Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
My name is Elmer Witt. I'm director of Holden Village, and I missed some of you this week because I had a good cold, and I had to escape a little bit and get down to Wenatchee and get recovered, so I'm glad to be back. What I entitled what we're going to do this morning is Almost a Bible Study. So I hope you'll be willing. I thought if you had all that competence this week with Ray Martin, you might be welcoming somebody who has to struggle a little more. I'm kidding, Ray Martin, of course. A number of ways to look at studying the scriptures. One is, you know, take a book and work at it and just plow through, look for the ideas. Another is to take a section and go at it maybe verse by verse and see what's there. I know Dan Erlander has a favorite Bible study of his in which he takes one verse and looks at about three words in it, and that's a very legitimate way of doing it, and upside down. Another way that I think is legitimate is what I plan to do this morning, is simply come to the whole of scriptures with a question. You know, what does the scriptures say? And my question is, does God laugh? In trying to get at that, I'll tell you in a little while why I got to that question. I'll tell you a couple reasons where I came to that question. But when I checked the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, which is a big four-volume thing that a lot of clergy use, I saw that the section in there went from L-A-T something, I forget what the word was, to L-A-W. There was no L-A-U in it. So I thought that was sort of a message by itself. I went to a little more popular book, a theological word book by Alan Richardson. And here's what I found in here. I'll read a little bit of this to you. This is a study of the resources of modern scholarship. It's not modern anymore. It's a good number of years old. To the key meaning of the key words of the Bible by Alan Richardson. Under the word laugh, behind it, it says mock, deride, scorn. You got a feel for it already, right? In the Bible, laughter does not denote amusement. And all the associations of laughter serve only to emphasize the difference between the mentality of the ancient world and that of the modern, or of the East and the West. And I thought that was curious all by itself. It'd be interesting to study that. What's the difference between an understanding of laughter between East and West, if that's really one of the differences? Between that of the ancient and modern, I guess I'm fairly well comfortable with. Most of the biblical associations of laughter are unpleasant. Though the preacher in Ecclesiastes admits there's a time for laughter, if you need to use your scriptures, why don't you do it right now? And look to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, one of the references to laughter. Old Testament Ecclesiastes, right. I'm working with a different version, so I can't give you a page number there. Somebody will find it. Ecclesiastes, got it? Isn't it Matthew, Mark, Luke, Ecclesiastes? Something like that. I always look for Psalms and keep going back from there, and then you bump into it occasionally. Eventually, okay? Why doesn't somebody read 3-8, just the whole section, and get a more of a feel for the whole thing? Would somebody read that? Anybody? Someone feels alert enough to read this morning? Ecclesiastes 3:1-8. Okay? Would someone read? Start at verse 1, would you?
A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep and a time to steal. a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Can we come back to the reference to that in a moment? That's one of the references that's here. And this says, though the preacher admits there is a time for laughter, he disapproves of it in Ecclesiastes 2, verse 2. Turn the page in Ecclesiastes to chapter 2, verse 2. In my translation, it reads, I said to myself, come, I will plunge into pleasures and enjoy myself. But this too was emptiness. Of laughter, I said, it is madness. And of pleasure, what is the good of that? So if you're going to stick around with Ecclesiastes, you're going to get some nice double messages about this, it seems to me. Laughter occasionally denotes joy at good fortune. Maybe you want to look at Psalm 126. Let's read that whole psalm also. Psalm 126. A little earlier in the book than Ecclesiastes. Got it? If somebody finds that, would you read that too, please? The whole psalm.
When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter, and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like the watercourse of the Negev. May those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. He that goes forth weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheep with him.
It seems to be closer to the joy motif, at least in that psalm. But much more frequently, continuing with Richardson here, much more frequently laughter denotes surprised incredulity, or most frequently of all, derision. That in the Psalms and elsewhere, we read of the scornful laughter and derision of the wicked or of the enemies of Israel, that they are deriding, laughing at those who take seriously God and and faith in God. In Luke 6:25, Jesus says, woe to you that laugh now. He's denouncing the attitude of derisive unbelief. Those of you who are making fun of those who believe, Jesus says, it's going to change for later on. When he says, blessed are ye that weep now, for ye shall laugh, he's very likely talking to that kind of laugh that we read about in Psalm 126. The Bible's not afraid of anthropomorphism, you know, talking about God in human terms, by any means. And God is sometimes depicted as laughing at the wicked or the proud, not in amusement, but in righteous scorn. Psalm 2:4 does that. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. He's looking at the people that are avoiding him, escaping him, denying him, and saying that they are not going to make it. The word mock, besides meaning deride, sometimes means to deceive. So the people of the Bible, unbelief, pride, blasphemy, and irreligion are objects of ridicule because they are so patently things which only a fool could countenance. Let me tell you why. One of the reasons I came to thinking about this, it really came out of the serious illness and death of my wife. Jenny died on March 8th of this year, and a whole part of our life together in the 9 weeks from when she came home from the hospital to die had to do with laughter. It was a critical part of our whole life together. It wasn't laughter that was an escape in any way from the seriousness of what had happened or of the separation that was going to take place, but it was a real dimension of our life together during that time. It was a part that, I don't want to say it was the most critical part, but it was an important dimension of it. went laughing at things that we consider terribly serious. It meant laughing at death. It meant laughing at our meager ways of trying to understand, or as Ginny said, most of all, her need to control. One of her lines was, I came home from the hospital 9 weeks before, expecting to think deep, serious thoughts. And the first thing God had me do was mend socks. And she talked with people like Marty and Joe Sittler, and she said, told them, I've been trying to have very deep thoughts, but they don't seem to come. And it was, though, and many of them were deep, but many of them were related to her ability to see the whole of what was going on, including the deterioration of her body and the impending day-counting shortness of her life as being part of the humor of the situation. One of the books that people send you if your wife gets cancer, just so, or your spouse gets cancer, in case you haven't heard, is we got, I think, 5 copies of this book in about the first 2 weeks after we learned about her cancer. It's the book by the Simonsons, which has to do with getting well again, has to do with the response to cancer. Excellent book. And the fact that we got a lot of them, we passed them out to other people. That was, I'm glad to do it. Part of the getting well again that they talk about in here and facing cancer, any serious disease, is the imaging that you do of the disease. How do you think about it? If you see it as overwhelming you and slowly eating away and tearing everything about, that's probably going to be the mood, the feel, and the kind of thing that's happening in all of your understanding of it. If, on the other hand, you are able, I think, by God's grace, to image it in a different way, then your, if you permit the word, enjoyment of your illness might be quite different. Then I said to myself, if this is so important in our whole life, that we do laugh a lot, that joy for us, celebration for us, does mean also laughter, not only, but does mean include laughter. But what about God? Does God laugh? Is the only revelation of God, the kind of passages we looked at, that God laughs in derision at other people? If God laughs, what would God be laughing at? That leads me to the other reason I came to this. I've been doing my studying for getting ready for next summer. I hope you recognize we have to be ready for next summer. I'm inviting teaching staff already for that time. And the book we're probably going to use is this one, Original Blessing by Matthew Fox. And one of my favorite themes that he gets at in this book is under the subject of holiness that he talks about. Holiness, he thinks, is a word to retrieve. One of the most telling questions, it's about a book about spirituality. Oh, by the way, I looked in this book for the word laughter or humor and couldn't find it. It made me a little wary about it. I'm going to have to, we're hoping we can get Matthew Fox to come up here and find out where he sees. He has ecstasy in there, and he has a number of other things, but it doesn't deal with the word laughter or humor. I have some questions about a spirituality that may not do it. He may see it where I don't. One of the most telling questions that he asked about a period's spirituality is its understanding of holiness, a people's grasp of that. Well, he goes on to say, there are several definitions. The one that comes out is, holiness is the quest for perfection. Coming out of the passage, be ye therefore perfect, as also your Father in heaven is perfect. At the Matthew 5:48 passage. And then he says, that's the one that he thinks has thwarted more spirituality than almost anything else. He quotes Otto Rank, who calls it the disease of perfection. The fact is that for people who have truly learned to trust creation, one of the first lessons is how beauty and imperfection go together. Every tree is beautiful. But if you approach it closely enough, you'll see that every tree is imperfect. The same is true of the human body. Every human body is beautiful, but every human body is imperfect. In nature, in creation, imperfection is not a sign of the absence of God. it is a sign that the ongoing creation is no easy thing. We all bear scars from this rugged process. Then later on, he turns to what he thinks that passage is about. The text invariably invoked for this simply does not refer to moral perfection, does not have here the later Greek meaning of being totally free of imperfection. The Greek word that's been misleadingly translated to be you perfect, telaioi, which means to be, really means be full grown, be adult, be complete, be whole, almost akin to the word shalom of the Old Testament. The text has a parallel in Luke's gospel, which could hardly be more straightforward. Matthew Fox, be you compassionate as your creator in heaven is compassionate. In other words, rather than perfection as we think about it, it is a call to compassion, backing up. What I think God must be laughing at is our terrible seriousness about being perfect. That informs still so much of our life, in spite of the grace of God, in spite of the announcement, the heralding of the gospel, in spite of St. Paul's helpful pushing us around back and forth to understand that when sin abounds, grace even all the more abounds, that we still find ourselves dealing so much with our perfection. Somebody in the earlier session said, he goes to so many meetings where they say, well, now really what we have to do is to get serious about this. You go to stewardship meeting, they say, now we got to get serious about stewardship. You go to evangelism meeting, you say, well, it's about time we get serious about evangelism. If you go to a meeting on the new church, somebody say, well, now let's really get serious about what we want in the new church. And this person said, I wonder what would happen if we turned it around and used the word humorous. Now, it's about time that we get humorous about stewardship. It's about time we get humorous about evangelism. And maybe we could really get humorous about the new church. How does that laughter of God, which, as I said, is not trivial, I'm not talking about telling jokes in a sermon, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the comic dimension of all of life that all of us are so much into. One of my favorite stories that I quote elsewhere a number of times is the story of Lily Tomlin, who tells about going to the store to buy a wastebasket, getting the wastebasket and putting it in a bag and taking it home and taking it out of the bag and crumpling up the bag and throwing it in the wastebasket. I love it. I love it. I think it's one of the funniest stories I've ever heard. Marvelous what it says about our consumerism or all the rest of the business and how we treat things. If it's true that so much of what we do is so downright funny, you want some piece of laughter. I hope this doesn't offend people. Think about intercourse for a moment. I think only a God with a sense of humor could have devised that means of sexual appropriation, or of joy and fun. The contortions people have to go through to enjoy themselves sexually. I think it's one of the outlandish jokes of God. It is marvelous. And yet we get very serious about that. Conrad Hires, whom some of you may know, has written a book and a number of books on the subject of holy laughter. And he has a quote from Reinhold Niebuhr that I thought was interesting in getting at this comic dimension. In other words, to approach all of Scripture with an understanding of this comic dimension of human existence. He quotes from Psalm 2:4, the one I quoted before, "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision." Just a few words from Niebuhr. This word of the second psalm is one of three instances in the scriptures in which laughter is attributed to God. God is not frequently thought of as possessing a sense of humor, though that quality would have to be attributed to a perfect personality, at least as we understand. There are critics of religion who regard it as deficient in the sense of humor. And they point to the fact that there's little laughter in the Bible. Why is it the scriptural literature, though filled with rejoicings and songs of praise, is not particularly distinguished for the expression of laughter? There are many sayings of Jesus which betray a touch of ironic humor. But on the whole, one must agree with the critics, who do not find much humor or laughter in the Bible. This supposed defect, now here's Niebuhr again, however, appears less remarkable if the relation of humor to faith is understood. Humor, in Niebuhr's contention, is in fact a prelude to faith. And laughter is the beginning of prayer. Laughter must be heard in the outer courts of religion, and the echoes of it should resound in the sanctuary. But there is no laughter in the Holy of Holies, in Niebuhr. Their laughter is swallowed up in prayer, and humor is fulfilled in faith. That's really all I want to say. But I'd invite your reaction and discussion about what you think, where you think laughter and humor belongs in the Christian faith, where you think God is in regard to humor and laughter, and indeed, if you want, what do you think God's laughing at today?
Seems sure. Like have this image of a God, you know, as a father with little kids running around. And what you were saying there just struck me as, you know, what's the funniest thing when you're an adult and you see your kids running around playing and stuff, and they're trying to act more adult than they are, more serious than they should. And it's just really humorous to see little kids trying to be really serious and really more than they need.
Dress-up games.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Someone else? Yes, please.
Abraham and Sarah laughed.
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
You lead me into temptation. I'm sorry. For those of you who know Frederick Buechner, of course, he's the fellow who introduces many of us to his book, Telling the Truth, The Gospel is Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. He has that marvelous story about Abraham and Sarah laughing. Let me just read parts of it. It's my need. If you've heard it before, put up with it. It's such a good illustration. I think every clergyman in the United States at least has used this, I don't know how many times. It's about that laughter. The old woman's name is Sarah, of course, and the old man's name is Abraham. They're laughing at the idea of a baby's being born in a geriatric ward and Medicare picking up the tab. They are laughing because the angel not only seems to believe it, but seems to expect them to believe it too. They are laughing because with part of themselves, they do believe it. They are laughing because with another part of themselves, they know it would take a fool to believe it. They are laughing because laughing is better than crying, and maybe not even all that different. They are laughing because if by some crazy chance it should just happen to come true that she has a baby, then they would really have something to laugh about. And they are laughing at God and with God, and they are laughing at themselves too, because laughter has that in common with weeping. No matter what the immediate occasion is for either your laughter or your tears, the object of both ends up being yourself and your own life. Then later on he picks up the same theme. According to Genesis, God intervenes at this point and asks about Sarah's laughter. And Sarah was scared stiff and denied the whole thing. And then God said, no, but you did laugh. And of course he was right. Maybe the most interesting part of all is that far from getting angry at them for laughing, God told them that when the baby was born, he wanted them to name the baby Isaac, which in Hebrew means laughter. So you can say that God not only tolerated their laughter, but blessed it, and in a sense joined in it himself, which makes it a very special laughter indeed. God and humanity laughing together, sharing a glorious joke in which both of them are involved. It is perhaps as important to look closely into the laughter of Abraham and Sarah as it is important to look closely into the tears of Jesus. Thank you. Somebody else, your reactions to laughter and humor. Oh, please, yeah, come on.
I think a lot of the humor in the Bible is more subtle. God is kind of, the Bible says that God stuff, the Lord made some kind of sun humor, especially in the Old Testament, like you just think of Noah. This poor old Noah building a boat in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
Hasn't rained there in 30 years. And on top of that, it's going to take 120 years to finish it.
Yeah. Bill Cosby does such a good job with that. You and me, God. You and me, God. Thunder comes. You and me, God. I'm on your side. That's funny. Interesting that many of the comedians are Jewish, huh? That the people who have suffered, who understand suffering in a way perhaps that many of us don't, that they are given to that. That's an interesting thing to me. Someone else.
I think part of it is just that God created you with this whole range of emotions. But to deny one as neat as laughter would be to be kind of crazy or something.
Yeah.
You know, why be sad if you have an ability to laugh too, given you? It's part of your creation.
It would be to deny creation. You say no? Okay, please.
I think maybe one of the reasons why people don't sense a laughter in God is because laughter is a response to the unexpected.
Yeah.
And I think we so fall in on this, our understanding of omnipotence, that we don't credit God with an ability to be surprised by his own creation. And I think that's one of the freedoms that God gave to God, was to be surprised by the creation that is here. And we do it quite regularly.
That, for instance, we wouldn't laugh at the resurrection. Totally unexpected. Totally unbelievable. Quote. It's that intersection of that unbelievableness that I think is the cause of it. You know, that's what the juxtaposition. You put two dumb things together, things that weren't together before, you put them together, and people laugh. If you walk along, and you're supposed to be walking, you slip on a banana peel and fall, the child laughs.
Yeah.
It's the unexpected.
Charlie Chaplin had the marvelous sense of that. He talks about his first experience of laughter in his autobiography was watching a group of men chasing a sheep that had gotten loose from a butcher shop next door to where he grew up in the south end of London. And just absolutely rolling on the street laughing, and then realizing that when they caught it, they took it inside and slaughtered it. And that went, boom.
Yep.
And if you catch Chaplin, that's the secret of Chaplin's humor through all his films, the pathos that's turned and the laughter that's turned into pathos, that going in either direction. Fascinating power.
Why does the clown have the mouth turned down so often? Because it makes you laugh in order to see yourself and to see the pathos of it. The seeing of the whole of creation and all the events, those unexpected things, as signs of hope also, that prelude to hope and prelude to faith that Niebuhr was talking about. That I think that is such a large thing that's part of our that's lost to our witness in Jesus Christ, that we don't recognize, even in the midst of whatever may be going on in the world, it's terrible, that still there's some juxtapositions of craziness to me is a sign yet that God's in the heavens, and that sign of hope that causes us to laugh even at that time. They tell me that the cartoons and humor of Germany were at their peak during World War II, mostly when they were losing. They had to have that escape. That's the sign that we can survive because of God in the midst of a crazy, crazy, crazy world. So I guess maybe giving one another permission, not only to tell jokes and to be funny and to do dumb things, which is all part of it, but also to laugh at the most serious things. And now we're back to know, what we're talking about in terms of death. And we are so afraid, not only of facing it, but of talking about it. And I don't mean to trivialize it again, in no way, but to say, to see that as part of that, wrapping up the paper and throwing it back in the wastebasket. That is not, again, I don't mean to say that life isn't worth anything, but there is a dimension in which we take that paper again and wrap it up. And that's gone, but something else lasts that's much more important.
This is kind of a question, but is some of our, kind of a fear or something in us towards being too funny or too, you know, feeling too humorous about God and the things of God, kind of a product of a sort of ascetic Christianity in our cats, like a feeling that if we have too much fun, we're not holy enough, or we're enjoying things too much.
What do you think? Sure, right?
Probably partly grows out of attitude toward a greater person. It would be very improper at the wrong time to laugh in the presence of a king in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of carried that over. God is so transcendent that we think we always got to be very, very awe-filled and serious whenever we think of God. Because if God made us able to laugh, it shows to me laughter is part of God's being. And I think he enjoys good children so often.
Anybody else got a response to that?
Yes.
Sure, please.
Well, could it be that maybe we have been scorned in a way or at a time and hurt by laughter, and therefore it's not as funny as maybe it could be? I mean, Lee Griffin talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
The author, he says, the cost of laughter,
mm-hmm.
or the cost of
sure.
the bad joke.
Sure.
Who's the guy? Don Rickles.
Yes.
You contrast Don Rickles to Joni Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Rivers, for example. She does a lot of it on herself. She gets others too, but Don Rickles is cruel in my church.
Yeah, laughter is cruel. There's no question. Laughter can be cruel. Very, very, very question about it. Children can be cruel with laughter.
Oh, yeah.
No question about that. They're well trained. They've been not always learn all the other things from us, but they'll often learn that. Sure. I suppose that's a part of it. The aesthetic maybe background, but then also the danger of humor, the misunderstanding of it. It's a difficult piece of communication because you don't know, not everybody catches, quote, the joke, the intersection, the juxtaposition at the same way. And then, as I think you're saying, we've all been made fun of somewhere along the line, probably from early on. And that we maybe carry on. Yeah.
what I have experienced is that through the right kind of humor, the right kind of jokes, it becomes a kind of a window to a reality which you otherwise won't see.
Mm-hmm. Some have reaction to that? So you're saying to have that window clouded, you're going to not see a part of the view of human existence.
Doesn't Jesus do that in the parables? Remember the speck in your eye, the log in your eye?
Sure.
That's humor there.
Surely is.
That he made it clear then.
Mm-hmm. Someone else?
Elmer?
Yes.
You mentioned Bill Cosby.
Sure.
A while back. We were fortunate to see his show and concert a few weeks back.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the magnificent, beautiful things that he is able to do is his show currently, he's talking about raising his own children.
Yes.
And to look at these family situations that anyone who has been a parent has been involved in, and at the time you're in them, there is absolutely nothing humorous about them. But to have someone sitting on the stage and looking at them for you, you fall off your chair because they are so absolutely funny. He says these things like, children make you talk the way you never intended to talk. You'll repeat yourself seven times. Stop that. Stop, 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 stop. Stop it, I say. Stop, stop, stop. And at the time you're doing that, it is not funny. You're aggravated, you're irritated, you're ready to pound the kid into the wall or something. But when someone stops you and looks at that, it's suddenly very funny. And I can't help but wonder if perhaps God doesn't do the same thing as he watches us. Someone earlier mentioned God as the father, the parent, watching us as children, trying to do all these various things. And sometimes it's God doesn't see us going through all of these things that we're so wrapped up in and just fall off the chair laughing.
And one of his lines in that same kind of show, I haven't seen the show, but I've heard some of his tapes, is that all of his children are brain damaged.
Yeah.
He says, you say, who did this? I don't know. And where's your brother? I don't know. Did your mother tell you? I don't know. All I say is, I don't know. They're brain damaged. They all know. Marvelous sense of humor. We always tried to, back in Walter League days, when I was with Walter League, we were trying to get, what is his name? The guy who did Chungking ads. No, I mean the writer.
Dan Freeberg.
Pardon?
Stan Freeberg.
Yeah, Stan Freeberg. Yeah. We always wanted to get Stan Freeberg to write a liturgy for us. Stan really understood music, he understood humor, he understood words in a marvelous way, and he had the background. I think his dad was Presbyterian minister. It would have been marvelous to do something like that because he understood how to put all that together in a quote commercial way, one that we quote sell that people would understand. Would have been good to do.
I think it's helpful too for people who are going through those difficult times to see people who have gone through them laughing about it. There gives mm-hmm. a little bit of hope that you're going to survive.
Yeah, right.
Traumatic time, but
my wife had a life of a ministry, no question about it, in many, many ways. But nothing was more important than her last 9 weeks, the ministry that she gave to other people because of her ability in the midst of that to be of good cheer and to insist that people who visited her would talk about it, would talk about death, but would see it, not as a... The most difficulty she had was people who wanted her to be healed their way. And when she would try to convince them that God was healing her through death, it was very difficult for them to accept. But that was part of her ministry. And part of that was to be able to joke about it, to laugh about it, to see how silly the whole business was of her, as she talked about it, her need to control She was really irritated. She came home to die. She thought it would be about 3 weeks, and it lasted 9 weeks. She was embarrassed that she was lasting that long. But she said, you know, I wanted to be in control. I wanted to end in 3 weeks and be done with, and, you know, and you could go on to hold and all this kind of stuff. And she says, God had another lesson for me before I go.
How did you do that?
Well, the thing I said to the doctor when he told me, a little sawed-off Jewish doctor that I probably hadn't said 10 words to before in my life, that told me that my wife had cancer. My first response is that she's a woman of faith, Doc. So we got to know the whole stuff. And I think that was what it was. She had been prepared by depression and therapy. And she, for her, cancer was a snap compared to that. Because in depression, she had been rejected. She felt rejected. She was rejected. She was even hospitalized and put away, and, you know, and people, and in cancer, everybody came. Everybody wrote. Everybody supported. Everybody cared. And so for her, the pain was not that bad. And it was just comparatively a snap. That's her line. It's a snap, Doc, she said to her oncologist, when he was bothered that she wasn't crying all the time. She said, I've been there. She was never depressed. But that's the sign of faith. A Jewish psychologist helped her to see faith in a new way. Oh my. I don't think I ever saw the grace of God more fully than I did with Bob Postel, who was a Jewish psychologist. Yeah?
I've been sitting here through this whole discussion thinking about Paul's admonition to weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. And to think about those with whom we can laugh and those who will laugh with us as a real strength of community. I think some of what you shared from your wife's illness demonstrates that sometimes we're stronger weeping with those who weep, and we're used to that, we're willing to do that. But I know for myself, the most solid support, the most substantial friend, are those who will laugh with me.
Sure. A bit of an indictment is that pastors are often better at hospital calls than they are at celebrations in bringing their message. They can enjoy too, but they have something significant to say at a breakthrough, at a powerful part of a person's life. We tend to be trained that when people are flat and looking up, then we can be standing up and giving them a good message. But when they're up, do we have as much to say? And that's that celebration, to join in their celebration of life, their victories over whatever it may be. It could be in corporate structure, could be in just hacking at once against drink or whatever. To be able to rejoice with those who rejoice. That's why the village is so committed to having fun, too. You know, the 4th of July celebration we had a week ago, it's just crazy as can be. It's a part of our craziness because we have to, it's one of the ways we rejoice with them. Yeah.
Going along with it, I don't know if it's part of our Christian ethic or what, but there are many times I feel I have more license to vocalize when I'm flat than when I'm upright and celebrating. And I don't, it kind of feeling like it's either boastful or out of place.
Yeah. Good point. To rejoice in God's creation, whatever that may be, an accomplishment of your own. That's what, my dear wife were here and teaching some of her sessions. One of her sessions is, what is the most important thing it is for your child to learn about you? And guess all kinds of things. And her contention was, from her experience as well as from her reading, was to allow your child to hear you boast rightfully about something. Be proud of yourself. That will do as much in building a good image of that child, that it's possible to rejoice in what God gives you, in what you experience at the hand of God. I think that's right. That's that perfection again. There's some imperfection in boasting in God. Or just the risk. So it be a little imperfection. You know? Somebody else.
Yeah, I think so many of us have been conditioned to feel that it was wrong to vote.
Yeah.
I remember the first class I took at the university where the professor told us we had to give ourselves our own grades. I really had a rough time.
Sure. That's one way to keep the curve down.
I was just listening to a tape that you have here in your resource. Al Robbins does a good job on humor.
Right.
The reconciliation, forgiveness theme with it.
Yes.
We're talking about, you know, boasting and weeping and laughing.
Yeah.
And I led a Bible study a few weeks ago at a youth retreat on humility. I think if we boil it down, if we really look into the word humility and being humble beings, it's seeing truthfully. It's seeing things as they really are. You know, being humble isn't just saying, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. You know, you're better than I am, you're better than I am. Being humble is being able to say, you know, you did a good job on this, and I did a good job on this, we worked well together. And for me, being humble is being honest and seeing things rightly. And that's, so there, I think there is, again, like you started off with, a time to boast and a time to play out.
Sure. And we can abuse every good thing. That's what we're best at. We're abusing the good things. But then because we abuse good things, let's not put the good thing down. If your good thing is beauty, you can abuse it by the way you use it. Your good thing is a gift of money or whatever it is, you can abuse it. If it's intelligence, you can use it. If it's a sense of humor, if it's an accomplishment, sure, you can use that in the wrong way. But as soon as we say, well, therefore we won't, then we have denied, it seems, the gift of creation. If I understand what Fox is saying about humility, he associates it with humus, with the earth. And it is being of the earth, the reality of what is around us. And so it is our identification with this temporariness, if you will, of all those things. Of our stacking up stuff and worrying about whatever it may be. That's the silliness of stewardship, for instance. God needs what we got. Does that make sense? It's really strange. You know? And yet it's there. You know, that's a silly concept. And yet it's of the truth that God wants, depends on us, which is really, really, really crazy. And close to the grace of God, which doesn't make any sense at all. If it made sense, you know, we could figure it out and chart it and distribute it. Or inject it or something like that. It's not the way it works. It's that why it has to be a gift. Because you wouldn't figure it out. You couldn't figure it out. God's grace. Poets help us a lot. Artists. Why they are so important to us. Novelists. Who have these senses of bringing these things up again for us to see ourselves. I think it's marvelous. I got a poem I wanted to read. I think it's one that everybody else had heard many times, and I finally caught up with it a couple of years ago. Do you remember? The Reflections on a Gift of a Watermelon Pickle? During that summer when unicorns were still possible, when the purpose of knees was to be skinned, when shiny horse chestnuts hollowed out, fitted with straws, crammed with tobacco, stolen from butts in the family ashtrays, were puffed in green lizard silence, while straddling thick branches far above and away from the softened effects of civilization. During that summer, which may never have been at all, but which was become more real than the one that was, watermelons ruled. Thick pink imperial slices, melting frigidly on sun-parched tongues, dribbling from chins, leaving the best part, the black bullet seeds, to be spit out in rapid fire, against the wall, against the wind, against each other. And when the ammunition was spent, there was always another bite. It was the summer of limitless bites, of hungers quickly felt and quickly forgotten, with the next careless gorging. The bites are fewer now, Each one is savored lingeringly, swallowed reluctantly, but in a jar put up by Felicity. The summer, which maybe never was, has been captured and preserved. And when we unscrew the lid and slice off a piece and let it linger on our tongue, unicorns become possible again. I love that. A sense of what that was all about, the craziness of watermelons. A celebration of the earth, of God's gift.
I think that sort of goes with what we were told this morning at breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
We were asked why we were smiling or not smiling about our food that we were eating here. Maybe we know why the children aren't smiling.
And why we smile or don't smile at the other Eucharist. I don't know if you catch on, you know, how people try to work on you when you go to Eucharist, at least when you're up here, is that when you're given the bread, if the people serving you are doing their job well, they'll take the piece of bread and hold it up. Usually hold it up high so that you look at it. You know, it's come down, you know, you're always being very humble. You come with your head down, and you hold it up so you will look up. So they catch your eye with the possibility of an exchange between you and that person. The Eucharist is between us and God. It's His meal, of course. But it's also between us because we are called to share it together. And the possibility even of smiling, of celebrating in terms of a smile as you take the bread, as you share the wine. Remember we said, celebrate. You celebrate the Lord's Supper. You know, we spend so much time on, quote, repentance, not in the sense of turning around and going another direction, but of feeling bad so we can feel good later on. And our organist learned well from us and played in minor key for years. I remember during communion, all my growing up, it was all at the celebration. And now some of that is changing. You know, some of the music and everything else is helping us. And now some of us are also looking for that personal contact. One of the great celebrations that my wife and I enjoyed at the Black Parish that we were members of was that celebration at the table. And why, in preparing for her memorial service, as she put together what she wanted to do there, I had said, she wanted it short, of course. Good layperson. And I said, but honey, I really feel we ought to celebrate the Eucharist. And well, she didn't know. That was going to make it pretty long. And I said, but the one thing that I've heard you speak about most at Windsor Park Lutheran Church was the joy you felt at people of different cultures and colors being together at the Lord's table. And that evening she said, ah, you're right. You're right, we have to. We have to have Eucharist. And so the 400 plus people that gathered that day all came and shared the Eucharist. All kinds of people, black and white, Jewish and Christian, who came to the Lord's table on that day. And I think, you know, in all the tears, they were as celebrative tears as anything else. That meal, too, is part of our joy. And I think, once in a while, singling, it's nice to be quiet. I think silence is marvelous, too. But also, there's a need for our sharing our joy, the smile to another person. It doesn't only have to happen at the sharing of the peace, it can be at the sharing of the bread too, and the sharing of the wine. It's a good thing to take back to your parish. If you don't have it, you might have it already.
But how do you help your older generation feel that that's not being irreverent?
Slowly. Yeah. And some of the other lady, our dear friend, Marilyn lived only a block and a half from us, where we 27 years. This is, across the street from me. I can't even think of her name now. Anyway, she was up in years, and she was so distraught when her pastor began to say, the Lord bless you rather than the Lord bless thee. Well, I was just going to let her be there. I was going to try to change her. the next generation maybe we'd get at or something like that. So knowing when it's worth working on it or not is part of it, I think. But old people laugh a lot and have fun. That's why they're so good for little kids, you know, they can laugh there too. And somehow to translate that, I guess, into, if it's so good for them, it must be a gift, as Ray was saying before, it must be God's gift. But I would do it slowly. They were trained in a whole different way, and I want to be very, very patient. At the same time, I don't think we have to give it up. Funny how I forgot a name already. Been gone 4 months. Anyone else?
I just see Jesus sitting back his head and laughing, or at least smiling when we see an insight as we're studying scripture. I can just see him being real happy and pleased with that when we discover that.
I can see him smothering a chuckle when James and John's mother comes up and says, "Hey, can my kids sit on either side?" And that knowing chuckle. Yeah. You really know what you're asking for, don't you? Yeah.
Can you imagine 5,000 plus people sitting on a grassy hillside suddenly having bread and fish laid out for them with men and women and children, and there not being some laughing and kids running around playing tag and whatever they played in those days? You know, Jesus and his disciples joining right in.
Sure. I surely believe it.
Or Jesus' mom coming up to him during the wedding feast and saying, "We need more wine." And him standing there saying, "Well, it's not any of our business.
Yeah.
It's not my wedding."
Not my problem.
Elmer?
Yes.
Up here.
Over.
I think all of us remember, or can only remember, Reader's Digest having this one section of laughter is the best medicine. And now it's come full around, or Norman Cousins has been dealing with this subject, and I'm sure we're all acquainted with that. And then there are the stress management type of organizations, therapists that come together. And one of the therapies is that when you are feeling anxiety or feeling fear or anything, is you smile inside. And I've been through that a little bit, so I think I'm sure many of you others have too. But it is awful hard not to have good feelings and good thoughts when you're smiling. Even though you feel terrible, you just put a smile on inside and suddenly there is a good feeling, this connection between love, I think, and laughter, rather than, you know, it's incompatible with fear. You know, they can't go together. But I just try that sometime. If you ever are feeling rotten, just smile inside, and before you know it, that rottenness starts to fade. It will fade, absolutely.
And to have that connected with the power of God, that's because of Jesus Christ that you can do that. That there is hope at the moment of despair, at the moment of separation, the moment of death, whatever it may be, because of God's love for us in Jesus Christ. To connect that to the heart and core of the faith, rather than being simply a stress management factor process, which is good that it's being used. I only rejoice in that. But to have that tie to the very core and heart of the revelation of God, that he is a friend, and that he is for the positiveness, and that he's there for the joy, that I came to give you life in its fullness, including all of that joy and all of that sorrow mixed together in God's secret formula that means real life and long life and eternal life. Time's up. Thank you much.
I think you should have the pastors wear these emblazoned t-shirts that say, "Pastors do it with amazing grace."